Well, in May 2025, following graduation, members of the BGU Bible faculty held a series of meetings, and we discussed the BGU core Bible classes. These are the classes that everyone takes. And since several Bible faculty teach these courses, we wanted to be certain that the most important passages in the Bible were being taught somewhere in the core. But of course, we first had to decide which passages were the most important. That's not to say that some passages are more inspired than others, but obviously, if you're attempting to explain the gospel, you'll spend more time in John 3 than in a genealogy in 1 Chronicles chapter 3. And we concluded with a list of 50 chapters, but even among those 50, there were three or four that came immediately to everyone's mind. And in fact, I think the first chapter that was named was Hebrews chapter 8, the passage we have reached. But before we actually turn there, would you turn to Hebrews chapter 5? In Hebrews 5, the author is going to tip you off to just how important Hebrews 8 really is. Now, of course, there were no chapter divisions in the original, but those chapter divisions mark off certain units of thought and help us to navigate the text. In Hebrews 5, our author introduced Jesus' new high priesthood. Verse 10 speaks of Jesus being designated by God a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. A relatively obscure Old Testament figure will become Hebrews' quintessential type of Christ. But just how important is Melchizedek? Well, recall the next verse. About this, we have much to say. The author has a great deal to say about the Melchizedekian priesthood of Jesus Christ, but it's not going to be easy. And so, through the end of chapter 6, the author warns his readers to really cling to sound doctrine. But don't lose sight of verse 11. About this, we have much to say. That statement tells you the author's discussion of Melchizedek is really crucial. So where do you find that information? Well, the author does not get back to it until the final verse of chapter 6 and then all of chapter 7. Notice Hebrews 6 verse 20 and then chapter 7 1, where Jesus has gone as a forerunner on our behalf, having become a high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. With this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, met Abraham, returning from the slaughter of the kings, and blessed him. What follows, of course, is a whole chapter on Melchizedek, and we spent 2 weeks just working through that entire chapter twice. So given that, does chapter 7 go on your list of 50 most important chapters in the Bible? Well, it certainly made it on our list. Structurally, the way the author introduces Melchizedek and then spends a whole chapter in chapter 6 warning us to pay very careful attention to what he's about to say and then spends another whole chapter explaining Melchizedek, that tells you chapter 7 is really crucial. But even after working through chapter 7, would you notice the first line of chapter 8? Now, the point. And what we are saying is this. Ever had a conversation with somebody, he finally comes around and says, now this is the point, right? This is the main point. As important as chapter 7 was, chapter 8 is going to bring us around to the main point. What was the author driving at ever since Hebrews chapter 4 when he first named Melchizedek? Well, here's the main point. Just keep reading. Friends, we have such a high priest, one who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven, a minister in the holy places in the true tent that the Lord set up, not man. And that is the wonderful truth the author has been preparing us for ever since chapter 5. But in reality, he has been preparing us for this truth since chapter 1. Would you turn all the way back at this point to the first paragraph of Hebrews? Hebrews chapter 1. And if you recall, the author just dispenses with a regular epistolary introduction, and he greets us instead with a rapturous view of Jesus Christ as God's ultimate revelation. Verses 1 through 4 rank among the most dense theological paragraphs ever penned. The author writes, long ago, at many times and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets. But in these last days, He has spoken to us by His Son, whom He appointed the heir of all things, through whom also He created the world. He is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of His nature. And He upholds the universe by the word of His power. After making purification for sins, He sat down at the right hand of the Majesty on high, having become as much superior to angels as the name He has inherited is more excellent than theirs. Friends, the Son is God's definitive revelation of Himself to mankind. He surpasses all Old Testament revelation. The Son is both the Creator and the Sustainer of creation by the Word of His power. The Son is very God of very God, the exact imprint of the very nature of God. The Son is greater than all those bright angels. But beyond all that, the second half of verse 3 tells us He made purification for sins. And then He sat down. He sat down at the right hand of the Majesty on high. Friends, there was no chair in the tabernacle or temple. The priest's work was never done. However, the Son successfully purified His people from their sins and sat down. That statement, friends, is the very heartbeat of Hebrews 8 through 10. So what does it mean? Well, here we are, 8 chapters into the book, and we've only gotten a partial, incomplete answer to what He was saying here in verse 3. The time has come at long last for the author to really flesh out this glorious introductory statement. He made purification for sins, and He sat down. So let's return to Hebrews 8, and let's investigate the work of our great high priest, who is seated at the right hand of the Majesty on high. Hebrews chapter 8. I'm going to go ahead and read the entire chapter. Now the point and what we are saying is this. We have such a high priest, one who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the Majesty in heaven, a minister in the holy places, in the true tent that the Lord set up, not man. For every high priest is appointed to offer gifts and sacrifices. Thus it is necessary for this priest also to have something to offer. Now, if he were on earth, he would not be a priest at all, since there are priests who offer gifts according to the law. They serve a copy and shadow of the heavenly things. For when Moses was about to erect a tent, he was instructed by God, saying, "See that you make everything according to the pattern that was shown you on the mountain." But as it is, if you're reading NASB or King James, it says, "But now Christ has obtained a ministry that is as much more excellent than the old as the covenant He mediates is better, since it is enacted on better promises. For if that first covenant had been faultless, there would have been no occasion to look for a second." And now verse 8 introduces a lengthy citation of Jeremiah. "For he finds fault with them when he says, 'Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will establish a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. Not like the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt. For they did not continue in my covenant, and so I showed no concern for them, declares the Lord. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my laws into their minds and write them on their hearts, and I will be their God. and they shall be my people. And they shall not teach each one his neighbor, each one his brother, saying, Know the Lord. But they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest. For I will be merciful toward their iniquities, and I will remember their sins no more. And speaking of a new covenant, he makes the first one obsolete. And what is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away. Now, in reading the whole chapter, there are really three things that stand out. First, we have a new high priest, and he is seated at God's right hand. Second, we have a new covenant mediated by Jesus Christ. And third, the old covenant is obsolete. Your Bible divides into two covenants. We typically refer to them as testaments. Hebrews 8 explains the relationship between those two, the old and the new. At the center, the hinge between two covenants is Jesus Christ. So with that in place, let's work through the first six verses. The author writes, now the point, here it is, and what we are saying is this. We have such a high priest, one who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven. We were warned in chapter 6 not to fall away from Jesus Christ. Well, friends, why would that be so devastating, to fall away from Jesus? Well, think of it. At this very moment, you have a high priest, and he is seated at God's right hand. He is seated on the throne that only God can occupy. Where else will you find that kind of intercessor laboring on your behalf? What other religion offers anything like a human high priest seated at the right hand of God, very God, a very God? In all the Old Testament, is there any other high priest that you would prefer over Jesus? Is there another priest who wrenched his humanity from the grave and ascended with all authority over heaven and earth? So much of the Old Covenant, the Old Testament, finds its fulfillment in the session of Jesus Christ. Session comes from the Latin word for sitting. It describes the outcome of Jesus' ascension. You know, too often Christians think of Jesus like the star athlete whom the coach pulled off the field when he ran up the score by a comfortable margin. Friends, that is not what happened at the ascension. The ascension was the enthronement of the incarnate God-man to exercise permanent dominion where Adam fell. In Psalm 2, God sits on a throne in heaven laughing at the futile efforts of wicked nations to defy His rule. God rebukes him with a decree, "As for me, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill." The psalmist declares, "Now therefore, O kings, be wise. Be warned, O rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear, rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you perish in the way, for his wrath is quickly kindled. Blessed are all who take refuge in him." That's what happened at the ascension. In Psalm 110, Yahweh said to David's Lord, "Sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool." And Jesus applied the passage to himself just before his crucifixion. And he demonstrated its fulfillment by rising from the dead and ascending right up to God's right hand. In Daniel 7, the Son of Man alone is worthy to approach the Ancient of Days, seated on a flaming throne, and he is wreathed by hundreds of thousands of angelic ministers. And it is no coincidence that Jesus went everywhere identifying himself as the Son of Man. It's the Son of Man that approaches that throne. The session of Jesus Christ on the throne signals to all the angelic hosts spanning across the entire universe that the hinge of human history has swung from the old covenant to the new. We are in a whole new era now. Now, when we think of Jesus Christ at God's own right hand, don't think of his ministry as static, like the athlete now on the bench. Remember chapter 1. The author told us right now, he is upholding the whole universe by the word of his power. That's a really good excuse to do science, but I told my class this week. He's holding the whole universe up out there. Go investigate it. Now, verse 2 also speaks of Jesus' ongoing ministry. Jesus is a minister in the holy places, in the true tent that the Lord set up, not man. Jesus presently ministers in the true tabernacle. Now, we probably should not conceive of God building a tabernacle in heaven. The intended contrast is between Moses, who set up a temporary tent and priesthood, and God's everlasting presence. The tabernacle was transitory. It was movable. It was relatively light and doubtless in need of regular maintenance. Solomon built a temple of stone, as did Herod the Great, but even those stone temples came crashing down. The tabernacle and temple were transitory old covenant buildings. They were not the place of everlasting reunion between God and man any more than our church building is. We have a wonderful space in which we worship, but friends, this building is transitory. This is not the space of our permanent everlasting worship. The point is that Jesus presently ministers right up in the presence of God on our behalf. Now, verse 3 also speaks of the nature of priestly ministry. For every high priest is appointed to offer gifts and sacrifices. Thus, it is necessary for this priest also to have something to offer. Priests in ancient Israel offered gifts and sacrifices expressing thanksgiving to Yahweh and making atonement for sins committed. That was their job. That being true, to call Jesus a high priest necessarily implies that he too has something to offer. You wouldn't call Jesus a priest if he never offered a sacrifice, any more than you call a fisherman a man who never caught a fish, or a man a farmer who never planted crops. To call someone a builder implies that he's actually built a building. So to call someone a priest implies that he has in fact made a sacrifice. That's the point. But what's left unstated is precisely what kind of sacrifice Jesus offered. The author's point in Hebrews 8 is not to describe the sacrifice, but to establish Jesus' identity as the high priest, the mediator of the new covenant. But what's left unstated here in verse 3 will be explained in great detail in chapter 9. We almost need to put a little footnote here at verse 3 that says, okay, see the next chapter. All right, but let's quickly glance ahead. Look over at chapter 9 and verses 6 through 10. The author describes the regular offerings and sacrifice of the priest, especially the high priest who entered the most holy place once a year. But halfway through verse 9, the author makes an important clarification. Gifts and sacrifices offered that cannot perfect the conscience of the worshiper. Verse 11 greets us with a very important contrast. But when Christ appeared as high priest, something better is about to happen. Christ does not enter the holy place with the blood of animal sacrifice. Notice verse 12. He entered once for all into the holy places, not by means of the blood of goats and calves, but by means of his own blood, thus securing an eternal redemption. Friends, that is the greater sacrifice. Christ was a priest because Christ did indeed have something to offer in the holy place. What is it? His own blood. So again, what's left unsaid back in chapter 8, 3, verse 3, will be explained when we get to chapter 9. Suffice it to say that Jesus is a high priest because he has something to offer. Now, after asserting that Jesus is a high priest who offers a sacrifice, the author makes a statement that may surprise you. Verse 4. Now, if he were on earth, he would not be a priest at all, since they're priests who offer gifts according to the law. Quite literally, had Jesus remained on earth, he would be no high priest at all. This is true for several reasons, but in particular, Jesus was not a high priest according to the law. According to the law, a priest had to meet certain requirements. First, he had to be a Levite. Second, he had to be a descendant of Aaron to offer sacrifice as the high priest. Third, he had to undergo a formal ordination process involving washings, anointings, and the investiture of priestly garments. And fourth, he had to be ritually clean, including no contact with corpses. Well, Jesus raised the dead. Jesus is not a priest according to the Mosaic law. This is why we worked all of chapter 7 to establish there is another kind of priesthood, namely the Melchizedekian priesthood. Also, the phrase, if he were on earth, implies that Jesus' priesthood operates in a different realm, in a heavenly realm. This, again, is a theme that we'll find much greater explanation in chapter 9. But if you just glance ahead at chapter 9, verse 11, we read this. When Christ appeared as a high priest of the good things that have come, then through the greater and more perfect tent, not made with hands, that is, not of this creation, not Moses' tabernacle, he entered once for all into the holy places. Or look down at verse 24. For Christ has entered not into holy places made with hands, which are copies of the true things, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God on our behalf. Friends, Jesus' high priestly work just operates in an entirely different sphere, right there in the presence of God on our behalf. Jesus does not walk into a human building on the Day of Atonement. Jesus ascends right into the very presence of Yahweh. This greater reality just reduces that whole elaborate temple and tabernacle structure just to a copy, just to a shadow. Notice verse 5, chapter 8, 5. They serve a copy and shadow of the heavenly things. When Moses was about to erect the tent, he was instructed by God, saying, see that you make everything according to the pattern that was shown you on the mountain. There are three Greek terms here that communicate the relationship between that earthly sanctuary and the heavenly reality. Copy, shadow, and pattern. They do not imply an exact replica, like the Mayflower II, which is thought to imitate nearly exactly the original Mayflower. One of the most significant differences is the sheer size of the heavenly temple versus that little tiny minuscule tabernacle. The Holy of Holies in the tabernacle was a cube, 10 cubits in length, width, and height. That's roughly 15 feet. That's like the size of your living room. The heavenly temple is described in passages like Daniel 7 and Revelation 5, just staggers the imagination. Unlike the small laver that stood at the temple in the entrance, the heavenly temple has a sea of glass, like crystal. In the vault of that heavenly temple is a space so large that hundreds of thousands, millions of angels gather in to sing God's praises. The tabernacle, by comparison, had merely a covering of twisted linen, blue, purple, and scarlet, and embroidered cherubim. In the Holy of Holies, small cherubim angels adorned the Ark of the Covenant. But Ezekiel's description of the cherubim that carry God's throne imply immense beings, just staggering the imagination. They are exceedingly difficult even to describe. You read Ezekiel's like, what is he saying here? They fill the expanse of heaven. They stretch across Ezekiel's entire horizon. That's the heavenly temple. So the two terms, copy and pattern, communicate an analogous relationship between earthly tabernacle and temple and the heavenly temple. But the term shadow communicates the paltry insignificance of the tabernacle to actually speak to heavenly realities. It's just a shadow. Now, God did indeed give Moses a pattern on Mount Sinai for building a tabernacle. And Exodus' detailed description of the building communicates the intentionality behind God's design. The court, the holy place, the washings, the sacrifice, the veil, the cherubim, the mercy seat, all of that communicates something of God's holiness, God's separateness from sin. They also communicate the need for sacrifice and the hope for reunion with God through the veil by the sprinkling of the blood. But friends, none of that was permanent. The whole thing was a shadow, a dim, flattened, evanescent, ghostly specter of the greater reality to come. And speaking of shadows, the Old Testament narratives, when you read them closely, actually foreshadow the impermanence of both the tabernacle and the temple. In Exodus 32, there's a shocking story that punctuates the tabernacle narrative. God has liberated his people from Egypt and brought them to the foot of Mount Sinai, where he enters into a covenant with them. Beginning in chapter 5, the text describes the construction process for the tabernacle, a process that will not be completed until Exodus chapter 40. But right at the center of that narrative is the disastrous episode of the golden calf. Israel plunges into idolatry even while building the tabernacle. And that idolatrous beast was the very antithesis of the pattern that was shown you on the mountain. Later, when Solomon set out to build the temple, there are likewise several indications that this more permanent building was hardly permanent at all. Solomon had no sooner finished the temple and prayed his dedicatory prayer than God appeared and listened to his warning. God says, "But if you turn aside from following me, you or your children, and do not keep my commandments and my statutes that I have set before you, but go and serve other gods and worship them, then I will cut off Israel from the land that I have given them, and the house that I have consecrated for my name I will cast out of my sight. And this house will become a heap of ruins. Everyone passing by it will be astonished and will hiss, and they will say, 'Why has the Lord done thus in the land and to his house?'" The warning was there. This is merely a temporary building. Friends, imagine pouring all our resources out and building a beautiful new church building. And Jesus shows up the day that we dedicate it. And he says, "You know what? I may just tear that whole thing down." Well, that's what happened. That's what happened to Solomon's temple. It was utterly destroyed. And when we enter the New Testament world, we find a temple still under reconstruction. Herod's temple was an estimated 3 times taller than Solomon's. It dwarfed Solomon's temple. Josephus tells us the inner stones were fastened with iron so that no one would ever pull them apart. He tells us the building was built to last forever. And the most magnificent of all the temples was, in fact, the most short-lived. Consider the irony. The more permanent the building, the swifter its destruction. Now, friends, would you notice the next 4 words in our text, at least in the ESV, just 2 words in Greek, verse 6. "But as it is," the NIV reads, "but in fact," and I really like the KJV and the NASB here, they read, "but now." That's the Greek, "but now." The Greek words make a decisive, redemptive historical shift. These 2 small words, "but now," represent the dramatic moment when the hinge of human history turned. Keep a finger here and turn back to Romans chapter 3, where you'll find the identical Greek expression. Romans chapter 3. In Romans 3, we have what some commentators have called the greatest paragraph ever written. You might also think of Hebrews chapter 1, that first paragraph. as the greatest paragraph ever written. You can decide. But in Romans 1-3, Paul brings a sentence of universal condemnation against the entire human race. Jews, Gentiles alike. It is grim. It is appalling. His description of the human condition in Romans 3 is graphic. It is loathsome. Their throat is an open grave. There is none righteous, no, not one. The venom of asps is under their lips. Their feet are swift to shed blood. On and on the indictment goes. But suddenly, like the sun cresting over the morning horizon, two little words change everything. Verse 21, but now. Two words that change the world. Friends, that is the identical expression found in Hebrews 8 and verse 6. But now. The righteousness of God has been manifested apart from the law. Paul explains that God's own righteousness is available to all the unrighteous without law. Remember, the law was but a shadow. Verse 24 says, we are justified by His grace as a gift through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus, whom God put forward as a propitiation by His blood to be received by faith. Friends, that is the language of sacrifice. The word translated propitiation is the word elsewhere translated mercy seat or the covering of the ark in the temple. Everything changed with the coming of Jesus Christ. Now, Paul is going to explain how we are justified, but Paul, unlike Hebrews, does not really explain all the significance of the tabernacle in the temple. But the word here is the same, but now. The righteousness that we could never achieve through the law was given to us as a gift through Christ's sacrifice, when He brought the blood to sprinkle the mercy seat, the everlasting mercy seat on which God sits enthroned forever in His heavenly temple. Now with that in place, let's turn back to Hebrews chapter 8 and verse 6. And notice again those two little words, but now, but as it is. And notice also the two words, more excellent, and the single word, better. In my first sermon on Hebrews, we surveyed the whole book. And we located every instance where this word shows up. It's a Greek word that actually means better. That's why it's translated that way. Or superior. All right? Here's what we discovered in Hebrews. Jesus is superior to the angels. Superior to the law. Jesus offers a better salvation. He is a better intercessor. Jesus offers a superior covenant. He is a superior priest. Jesus ministers in a better temple. Jesus is a better possession than anything that we have in this life. Jesus offers a better salvation through a better blood offering, and Jesus offers a better country. Jesus offers a better resurrection. So again and again and again, the author points us to the absolute superiority of Jesus Christ. And guess what? All of that is available immediately. Verse 6, but now. But as it is, all of this is available in Christ. And why is that? We'll keep reading. Christ has obtained a ministry that is as much more excellent than the old, as the covenant He mediates is better, since it is enacted on better promises. Now, friends, I realize that this sermon has been very heavy on theology and short on application, but that is on purpose. What really is the application? Well, I want us to look back at the first verse, and I just want to end with the same application that I ended with last week, especially as we move now to participate in the Lord's Supper. What is the application? Well, look at verse 1. Here's the point. We have such a high priest, one who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven. Friends, do you really believe that? Would you like to talk with him? You have somebody seated at the right hand of God at this very moment. And He is your intercessor. He is your high priest. And He will communicate to God on your behalf.